From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the fourth and final segment in a series of discussions about the Paideia Proposal, a new book by Mortimer Adler. The Paideia Proposal argues for single-track, humanistic, and liberal education for all American youngsters. The panelists are Mortimer Adler, Pamela Mayer, Donald Stedman, Penelope Smith, and Thomas Houlihan. Mortimer Adler directs the Institute for Philosophical Research and serves as chairman of the editorial board of Encyclopedia Britannica. Pamela Mayer is superintendent of schools in Chapel Hill and Carrboro, North Carolina. Donald Stedman is associate vice president for academic affairs at the University of North Carolina. Penelope Smith teaches in the Asheboro, North Carolina School District. Thomas Houlihan is principal of the Clayton, North Carolina High School.
Professor Adler, yep. Pam Mayer, we've talked around a little bit the perhaps conflict between specialization, careerism, and the common good that we've described, yep. or the common purpose, I think, yep. is a more apt word. There have been others within our society who've talked about the negative results of careerism. Eric Fromm, David Reisman in The Lonely Crowd. When an individual molds their knowledge, their personality to be a marketable product, yeah. they lose some touch with themselves. Yeah. How can we bring together the need to deal with that head on, given the economic base on which our culture is founded?
I think... if you say everyone should be both a generalist and a specialist, a generally educated person and with some expertness in some particular field or some field of a special interest, you would then say one more thing: should be a generalist first and a specialist second, that he should become a generalist in the course of basic schooling, which is common schooling of all the children, should become a specialist either in the vocation he has chosen or in advanced schooling, professional schooling and graduate schooling. I don't think any conflict between those. You see, there's no reason why a lawyer should be an ignorant specialist, a generally uneducated man who's a very good, skillful lawyer or a skillful doctor or a skillful dentist. That's exactly what Ortega's complaining about in that chapter entitled The Barbarism of Specialization. There's no need for it. There's plenty of time for everyone to become both a generalist and a specialist. Generalist first, specialist second.
I guess that may lead to the question I had, Don Stedman here. If, the proposal could be viewed by some as sliding down the age scale what otherwise might be described as an excellent undergraduate education.
It is precisely that.
The question is, what becomes of higher education if this becomes successful?
I'm glad you asked the question. Suppose this were to be instituted at the level of basic schooling. Then there could be two kinds of colleges. One, I think, would be the ideal college for teachers to go to, four-year college, which you had, like this, at the basic level, still another 4 years of a required general, liberal, and humanistic course of study, intensifying what has been accomplished in the in the first 12 years, in 4 years more, at deeper and broader levels. The other kind of college would be a college in which you had a wide variety, as most colleges now are, of elective majors, the majors representing different specialties. I'd only say that in that second kind of college, it would be the more numerous by far. I would like to ask for one required minor, one required elective majors, and one required minor for all the children, for all the youngsters in college for 4 years. With that required minor for all the students, also taught by all the faculty. I mean, I want to overcome the specialization of the faculty, the departmental specialization. You see, in so many colleges, the department is more important than the college. The reason why most college curriculum committees end up in a exchange of favors to one another is that each department is vying for students, and if you put my course in your core curriculum, I'll put your course in. That's not the way to construct a general education, and it doesn't work at Harvard, doesn't work in place else either.
Another question I have, which is not unrelated but is sufficiently different, is that the public schools, I think, like Congress, do not have total freedom to move. Mm-hmm. Much of what they do has been legislated, mm-hmm. either by federal legislation, as with 94-142, or by state follow-on legislation mm-hmm. or special interests yeah. in that state. Now, a lot of that, those laws, those statutes, would have to either be removed or modified in order to implement the yeah. Paideia proposal.
You're absolutely right.
And that may be part of what you characterize as the community's involvement and curriculum development and the rest, but that's an important consideration.
Oh, it certainly is. Mm-hmm. There are many state mandates that would have to be overturned. There are many certification requirements that have to be overturned. For example, I probably wouldn't be certified to teach in any state in this union. I don't think I've got certifying qualifications.
Not unless you've taken a course in the history of every state in which you'd like to be licensed.
The point is that those changes have to be made, and that's why I'm interested in getting this book in the hands of congressional committees, state chairman of education committees in our state legislatures, and as well as in the federal Congress.
Or more importantly, their staff.
That's right, yeah.
Professor Tom Houlihan, one of the major concerns that a number of my colleagues have indicated is that maybe that this proposal will lead to even more elitism and discrimination than ever before, using the Japanese educational system as a model where in Japan there's a number, students have the same curriculum and so forth. And what's evolved in Japan in many instances is such intense competition.
And you're quite correct. In Japan, if you go to University of Tokyo from secondary school, you get jobs in government and the top
precisely,
banks.
I mean, precisely.
Actually, the higher it's incredibly bad.
And the pressure to get into that university is intense.
That need not follow from what we're saying. In fact, I'm glad you used the word elitism. Many people have said, because you're asking for high quality, that we're elitist. And I said, yes, we are elitist, but this is democratic elitism. Elitism for everybody, not for the few, you see. I think that consequence in Japan has something to do with the corporate and social structure of Japan, not with the educational system, you see. And I would do everything I could to fight it in the United States. I think it's a terrible consequence that have happened.
Well, for example, the preschool tutelage thing, come back to that. In Japan, many kindergarten children receive pre-training before mm-hmm. they take the mm-hmm. test to go into the particular school and so forth. You know, with the preschool idea that we've talked about here, would those kids have more of an advantage than others in this kind of thing?
No, I don't think so. I think the preschooling, that école maternelle, the preschool tutelage, is for those not to give them an advantage, but to overcome disadvantages.
Right.
Let me say a few things about both democracy and intellectual competition. According to the proposal, what you would like to see happen in schools is three things. You would like to see, thirdly, students prepared for the world of work, which seems to be what we do most of the time now. Primarily, you would like to see them prepared to lead a good life
and good
intellectually
citizens.
Enriching life.
Right.
And the other objective is to be good citizens. Yeah. And yet, in this democracy, we are frequently told a very hierarchical, or not necessarily hierarchical, but a very definite notion of what democracy is, which I think is sometimes very non-democratic. Oftentimes we translate in our laws democracy as education and Americanism with a very, very narrow range of what that means. And it seems to me that if we are going to train citizens to be democratic citizens in the best of all possible senses of that term, we're going to have to overcome our very narrow definition of what democratic or citizenship training is right now. And I think that's going to be very difficult given legislative constraints. And another problem that I see with the objectives has to do with this intellectual competition that you all were talking about. I am not so persuaded that Americans believe an intellectual life is part of a good life. I tend to think that that Richard Hofstadter's anti-intellectualism in America is a devastating indictment of what is all too correct an assessment of our society. So it seems to me that you've got two real problems here. How are mm-hmm. you going to deal with them?
Well, I have to let me speak personally from experience. I'm absolutely committed to the democratic faith in the educability of all human beings and their fundamental equality. They all should be able to lead the same kind of life, good life, various in many ways, but along with the same ultimate moral values. Then I go to either watch a football game on television or go to a baseball game. I look around at my fellow, I call them my fellow citizens, but that's a compliment that I shouldn't pay them. And I look at what they're wearing and what they're doing with their mouths and bodies. I say, can I be right? Wasn't Aristotle right that some of my nature's slaves? And some? Well, my faith goes deeper than that. You see, the reason why it goes deeper is that I said something at the beginning I want to repeat again. Democracy, in the full meaning of the term, commitment to the equality of all men as citizens, free men, with a voice in their own government, governed by their own consent, full universal suffrage, and the respect of all natural rights for everybody. That's less than 100 years old. It's not an old political system. Its institutions are fragile and young. It's going to take, I think, longer than this educational reform to make democracy a firm and stable form of government, and one that's working well. We haven't begun to do what we have to do, socially, economically, or educationally, to make democracy work as it should work. But let me say, in 1916, Dewey wrote Democracy in Education. To my knowledge, that's the first time in the history of the world those two words were ever put together in the title of the book. Or the idea of saying, what kind of education does a democratic society need? So that these are all new problems. Mm-hmm. That we haven't solved them yet is not surprising. I think we should stop beginning. We make a beginning, that's all.
Don Steadman again. This country's general policy and its educational policy, as reflected in the Statue of Liberty and its motto, is... accepted large numbers of immigrants, families, yes, children, and the rest, and absorbed and changed the educational system substantially. We're now into the front edge, many would believe farther, of implementation of that policy on our southwestern borders. Indeed, yep, in the next 10 years, we may be treated to the spectacle of hundreds of thousands of refugees pouring across the Texas and New Mexico and Arizona, California borders. This country has never seen that.
No.
We've had some boat people and so forth, yeah, and you've seen how we've responded to that. And if the Texas Supreme Court decision is still in effect, they'll all be entitled to a free public education. Now, if Padilla were in place, would it be able to absorb that shock? Would it be in the same way, or is that part of a remedial strategy? Or?
Well, that's a very difficult problem for the idea proposal to solve. Sure. You've got an emergency situation there that has all kinds of social and economic problems before you get to educational problems. The one thing I would like to say is that I hope we can save our country from ever becoming bilingual. I think English, anyone that comes to this country should be required to adopt English as its primary, his or her primary language, regardless of his point of origin. I think we never want to face the problem of Quebec or of Canada as a bilingual.
As opposed to multilingual.
Oh, that's quite different. I mean, but two languages are required for it. There's not even out in Vancouver, as remote from Quebec and Montreal as possible, all the signs are both in English and French. That's absurd, it seems to me, and wrong. And that's what, in some sense, is being asked for in the Southwest. That kind of bilingual set of institutions. No, I think that kind of immigration and the economic disruptions that it causes and the social adjustments that it requires are problems that have to be solved before we can reach the educational problem in that part of the country. I think you've raised a very, very serious and difficult problem. That is a temporary problem in the way of making the Paideia thing a national program.
Pam Mayer here. Please. Professor Adler, it seems to me that there may even be some danger in any national program, because I think, as Ms. Smith spoke to earlier, with a national approach to any curriculum, there is always that tendency then to, like we have seen with the whole movement towards basic skills.
But we understand this is not a national approach to it.
I think it's important to make that distinction.
I think it should be as pluralistic as the country wants it to be, yes, provided certain minimal points of reference are maintained. I mean, I would not yield for a moment on the exclusion of specialized job training from the first. I would not yield for a moment on the requirement of a second language. Mm-hmm. I would not yield for a moment about, I think, the primacy of the principal in the school. I would not yield for a moment on the notion that schooling must not be conceived as giving a person an education, but merely starting him on the process of becoming educated. But these are broad philosophical points within which all kinds of adaptations can be made. And I want to insist upon the pluralism. I mean, I don't want to be tarred and feathered with uniformity or any kind of monolithic scheme.
I think that's extremely important that the pluralism be there, but that the common purpose be broad enough.
Yeah. A community, intellectual, moral, spiritual, means a group of people having something in common. We lack a community of that kind in this country. We lack it in our colleges. As I said, most of you could go to any college in the country and ask the student body in graduation what one or more books they've all read and discussed with one another. The answer is, or what one more subjects, problems they've all considered, or what one or more ideas. There's nothing in common.
The same commentary, I think, by some contemporary researchers in education. Those who have said, what is an effective school? One of the primary ingredients is, can you go into that school? And can you ask the question, what are you doing here? What are you learning here? What are you about? Mm-hmm. To the extent that there is any commonality whatsoever, to that extent, has that school been found to be effective?
Right.
Professor Adler, yes. Tom Houlihan, one of the basic assumptions of this entire discussion is that the American school system is in a disastrous state. Is it true?
I can only say I think it is. I by disastrous, I mean I think it is not serving the young. It is not serving our political institutions and processes. It is not serving our military establishment. It is not serving our corporations. It is not serving the underprivileged minorities in this country. It is defeating them. It's defeating their belief that they have an equal chance in life with the more favored groups in the population. I think it is serving no one well. It's not even serving the teachers well, by giving them jobs that are respectable and good and enlivening, that are keeping their minds awake and going. The problem has been made by the fact that that school population has grown enormously in size, not only in quantity, but in heterogeneity, background. You know, that's the problem. And you can see that's one of the causes, along with the mistaken notion that if these children can't be all educated, you have to train most of them vocationally, you see, shunt them off the way the French did at age 11. I don't know the full history of it. I mean, I think when people say, well, why did it happen? What are the causes? I always say the causes are so various and so complicated, one can't give an account of what's happened in the last 80 or 70 years. But that has come down the line, that the schools are much worse than when I went to school at the beginning of the century. There's no any question about it. There are still in this country a small number of very good schools here and there. And there are a small number of very good private schools. Not all the private schools are good either, by the way. That's a mistaken notion. But if you took all the schools that you'd say, those are pretty good schools, it would be a very small fraction of the whole. And if you took the number of children that are well-schooled, it would be a very small fraction of the whole, which is, I think, what we're talking about.
Pam Mayer, again, I guess when you say that, as a school superintendent, of course it makes me feel very uncomfortable, but that's okay. I think cognitive dissonance is a growth-enhancing state to be in. On the other hand, I think that it's terribly important that we recognize that what we're talking about has evolved in the American public school, again, is what the consumer has requested. It is what the consumer has asked for.
Right, you're right.
And so
that's one of the causes.
The problem is not inherent in the public school. And
you're quite right.
The problem is inherent in what
society.
It is we want out of our society.
You're saying what I think is absolutely true. The education society has, it deserves to have, but what it is asked for. You're quite right.
Given if that's true, let me go back to Richard Hofstadter and anti-intellectualism again. I mean, if in fact what the consumer wants is what the consumer is getting, in order for this proposal to be operative, we have to change what the consumer wants. And I need some hints as to how to do that.
How were the heathen converted into Christians?
we have several committees of evangelical.
Evangelism is the only answer.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, what do? You persuade people that they're in the wrong, that their values are wrong, they're being reborn.
Let me suggest an additional ingredient, and that is, I don't agree entirely that it's a consumer-driven system, whether it's curriculum or structure. I think the educationists have interacted with the consumers. So one of the things that concerns serious educators is the extent to which educational research is valid, or their products, and further, their selling. I mean, there's no FDA for educational research products.
No, there is not.
And there maybe ought to be.
There should be.
Even though that system breaks down, as we all know. You know, what we see, and in a very exaggerated form in the 60s and the 70s, and all the grants and innovative projects and the rest, much of which was quite good, much of which was also hucksterism at its zenith.
That's right.
People oversold the potential for schools, schooling, and certain educational approaches, their long-term effects, and said nothing about cost, which is now coming home to roost.
And
I mean,
also,
there's sin on all sides.
I think Americans, maybe more than other people, are given to being trendy. There are all kinds of fads and foibles that get adopted for a short time and that really have a bad effect that even before they disappear.
Yeah.
We've had all kinds of those fads and foibles in our educational system.
Well, it's just enough to keep them going. You know, the Salk experience was a real winner, you know, and people keep hoping for that in other realms. There's just enough of those kinds of wins to come through to keep, it's a kind of variable ratio reinforcement schedule in the Skinnerian sense that keeps us all, you know, kind of hanging in there.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the fourth and final segment in a series of discussions with Mortimer Adler about his new book on educational reform, The Paideia Proposal. Mr. Adler is director of the Institute for Philosophical Research and serves as chairman of the editorial board of Encyclopedia Britannica. Soundings now turns to questions about another sort of reform. What to do about the long-standing social and cultural problems of America's prisons and penal system? On that topic, here are comments from Hal Crowther, a writer who lives in Raleigh, North Carolina.
We're training a formidable army to fight against us. We're training them just as the Marine Corps trains its recruits at Parris Island and Camp Lejeune. We take young men with limited experience and perspective and subject them to a brutal sink-or-swim survival course. Their instructors are the toughest, most seasoned fighters and killers available. They learn to harden themselves to their own suffering and the suffering of others. They learn to do what has to be done without squeamishness or conscience. The difference is that the Marines are graduated and sent off to fight America's enemies. Often they're not sure who those enemies are, and enemy identification becomes part of their orientation. The convict, when he reaches his peak of toughness and efficiency, is then marinated in hatred and frustration, sometimes for many years, before he gets to face the enemy. But he needs no help when it comes to identifying the enemy. You and I are the enemy. No news there, except perhaps for the notion of enemy identification. It's quite possible that the United States has no real sworn enemies outside its borders, at least no sworn enemies that it doesn't richly deserve. In their terror of any form of government that might take away some of their material advantages, our leaders repeatedly support wars against peasants who welcome socialist promises. Most Americans don't realize that this country is a special case. The poorest families in the United States have television, which gives them access to Dallas, Dynasty, and the myth of Horatio Alger. The peasants, Indians, and aboriginal peoples of the Third World lack the imagination to see themselves boarding Learjets in three-piece suits. They just want to eat. They make a poor sort of enemy. There are more dangerous enemies on every city street, enemies who can't be bought off with handouts or rhetoric. They may be badly nourished, but they're hardly weak from starvation. They have graduate degrees in urban warfare from the best schools. And for everyone on the battlefield, there are 10 more back at Alma Mater, just waiting for the door to swing open so they can take another crack at us, now that they know what they're doing. They know our weaknesses and blind spots. As their numbers increase and overcrowding enrages them, the day approaches when they won't wait, or have to wait, for anyone on the outside to open the door. Given the high percentage of non-white prisoners in our system, it's pointless to deny that racism is a major factor. The economic and legal positions of minorities aren't any better in the North or in most parts of this country. I think it's a mistake, though, to boil it all down to a Cold War between the races. There are other ancient attitudes at work. One Superior Court judge told a reporter, I quote, "The people of North Carolina really want folks to get hurt when they commit a crime." What he needed to do was define the people. At the top and at the bottom, this is a lawless country. The Attorney General went to prison, The president narrowly avoided it. The vice president was exposed as a common thief. John DeLorean tried to finance an automobile empire with cocaine. I talked to a businessman who said the economy of Miami, Florida would collapse without the drug traffic. In Miami, he said, most Mercedes automobiles are purchased with cash. The wealthy ignore the law because they know it will protect them. The poor scorn the law because they know it won't protect them. In the middle are the people the judge was talking about, the middle class that obeys the law and reacts with increasing fear and disgust to the news that no one else does. They're the people who always vote, who join committees and sign petitions, who form the elusive public that politicians respond to. They're religious people who know that the Lord said, vengeance is mine, but who don't trust the Lord to take his share. They have no ability to empathize with anyone even accused of committing a crime. They favor capital punishment and pass vengeful laws that fall ever more heavily on the minorities and the poor. We can thank them for our bursting prisons. Some of their attitudes are admirable, some of them are smug and infuriating. Most of them are attitudes we can no longer afford. Vengeance and Calvinism are luxuries that will be eliminated if the prison bomb is going to be defused. Ice-cold pragmatism is the only approach left. When I was young and heard Joan Baez sing Raise the Prisons to the Ground, I was ready to sing along. When I'd lived a little longer and seen some samples of the kinds of people our prisons hold, I blushed to think that Joan and I could have been such jackasses. I'm coming back around to seeing what she and the songwriter must have meant. They didn't mean that all inmates were political prisoners and innocent victims who deserved to be out marching hand in hand with the rest of us. They meant that no society could endure the internal rot of a hypocritical penal system that breeds and perpetuates every disease it claims to cure. The focus of any reform has to be the first offender. A person commits a serious crime for any of several reasons: psychological disorder, disorientation, distorted values, or just to demand help or at least attention in a desperate situation. Very rarely does a first offense identify a genuine bad seed, a public enemy who will have to be quarantined for the rest of his life. A sane society treats its first offenders as family members with problems. It makes every effort to understand them and keep them out of prison. It tries to show them that they were mistaken in believing that they were surrounded by enemies. These principles are present in our legal system, but often forgotten. The professionals who attempt to apply them are often shouted down by a paranoid, bloodthirsty public. If you operate on the garbage disposal theory of penology, you might as well go all the way and execute every felon, because every convict who survives his basic training is another enemy soldier. We're like a society with such a horror of leprosy that it takes everyone who shows up with a spot or a pimple and throws him in the leper colony. It spends millions for leper barracks and barbed wire and nothing for diagnosis or treatment of spot-causing diseases. Pretty soon, of course, there'll be more lepers than leper hunters, and the colony will be so huge that it will be impossible to secure its gates or patrol its borders.
Hal Crowther is a writer who lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, where his columns appear in The Spectator magazine. You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.